Hello, this is Severin Borenstein. I'm a professor at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business and faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas.
I'm Ryan Kellogg. I'm a professor at the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy and deputy dean for academic programs.
And we're here today to talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting oil markets and government policies towards oil. So Ryan, the first thing to talk about is what this is doing to oil production. And you've thought a lot about how that differs between drilling new wells and continuing to produce from existing wells. So we're recording this morning on the morning of April 1st, and the price of oil looks to be around $20 a barrel. What's that doing to both of those decisions?
Yeah, so these are oil prices that we pretty much have not seen since around 9/11. That was pretty much the last time we had oil prices really anywhere near 20 bucks a barrel. So what's this going to do? If you think about the U.S., the number one thing you think about is the shale oil boom, which has been the big story in U.S. oil production for the past 10 years almost at this point. At 20 bucks a barrel, you can't make money drilling shale wells. It's a non-starter. You look at the numbers you see for drilling wells in the Permian Basin, really in West Texas, the best shale play there is. To profitably drill and frack a new well, you need something in the neighborhood of $40 oil. So in terms of new drilling, what we're gonna see in the US is drilling of new wells basically go down to almost zero. What does that mean for production? The production lag, the production hit, it's coming. We're not going to see it yet. You're not going to see it in the March numbers. You're not going to see it in the April numbers. But what you will start to see as we move later into spring and certainly into summer is the steady growth in U.S. production that's been happening over the past couple years, getting close to 13 million barrels a day of production. That's going to start to turn the other way.
And so that's the change in the drilling of new wells. Are we going to see any change in production from existing wells, do you think?
I think that's still a big open question. So if prices stay at $20 and don't go much lower, my guess is you're not going to see a huge change in production from existing wells. You might see some what are known as stripper wells that like really old wells that produce a barrel a day, two barrels a day, things like that. It's really hard for those wells to make money and make more money than their operating costs when oil is only 20 bucks a barrel. So some of those wells might shut in. That accounts for maybe a million barrels or so of total U.S. production. So you might see a little bit of that shut in, but any wells that have been drilled within the past couple of years that are still producing quantities of oil you care about, those aren't going to shut in, at least not yet. That story changes, though, if oil keeps going down. And if we start seeing oil in the low teens or single digits, producers are going to have some really hard decisions to make about whether to shut in wells that are real producers.
And so you've actually done some work on this with Soren Anderson and Steve Salant, making this distinction between continuing to produce from existing wells and drilling new wells. The work you guys were doing, though, was mostly talking about conventional drilling, wasn't it? The drilling a well that's going to last for many, many years and keeping the pressure in it. Whereas hydraulic fracturing is almost a different production process. It's more of an industrial production process.
Yeah, and I think the big difference to keep in mind between modern shale wells versus conventional wells, like folks were drilling in pretty much all of the 20th century, even though there was some low scale fracking going on, is that these modern shale wells, once you spend a bunch of money to drill these things and there's a huge investment up front, once that's done, the well will flow for a long period of time. You're probably going to have to put a pump jack on it and mechanically pump the oil out of the ground and start to do that at some point. That does cost operating cost money. The big cost investment is still up front, but these wells, once they're drilled and completed and start producing, their production naturally declines very, very quickly. So a typical shale well in West Texas, a year after it's drilled, it's probably producing at something around half the rate it was producing right after it was first drilled. The production rate declines are really, really steep initially. So part of what we're going to see, if oil demand continues to be really low for a long period of time, right now we're looking at something like a 20% drop in global oil demand. If that persists for a long period of time, what you're going to start to see is a race between how quickly production from existing wells declines versus how quickly we're going to fill up storage. Because it's really when we completely fill up all the storage and oil is stored in every storage tank, every underground cavern, every oil tanker, every rail car that could possibly be filled up with crude oil. Once that happens, that's when you're really going to see prices start to fall plausibly into the single digits if we get to that point.
Yeah, and there have been a couple of new reports out just this morning related to that. One was that the U.S. crude oil inventories increased by 10 million barrels this week, which is one day of production. So that's, I think, really way out in the tail. And the other is that we're seeing rental rates for tankers go way up because there isn't much demand for moving oil around the world. There's a lot of demand for storing it, which relates, of course, to what we're seeing in the crude oil futures market, an extreme contango. I don't remember this happening before, that the year out or 18 month out price is about double the spot price right now. So putting oil into storage for a year or a year and a half will get you nearly 100% return. That seems like a pretty good deal.
Yeah, if I owned a 2 million barrel super crude oil tanker right now, I feel like I'd be sitting pretty. Basically, fill me up, park me. I don't even have to go anywhere. Don't have to burn any fuel. And just sit there for a year, lock in a return. And yeah, 100% is not too bad.
Which brings us to talk about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which there was this discussion as part of the stimulus bill that passed last week of filling up the SPR, which didn't actually make it into the stimulus bill. But it seems like there's some pretty strong economic arguments, regardless of the political motivation of supporting the price of oil, just for the government to make some money storing oil in the SPR.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like if we can lock in 100% return for taxpayers, I mean, there's some storage costs. The SPR isn't free. It's an awful lot cheaper than putting oil in a tanker offshore or on rail cars or all the other things folks are doing in the private market.
My impression.
Yeah, we should be doing it, right?
It sure sounds like it from a strictly economic point of view. My memory is that the SPR has about a 700 million barrel capacity, and we're around 500 or 550 right now. Do you know that number off the top of your head?
Not off the top of my head. The numbers you mentioned sound ballpark right from what I remember.
So if you're putting 200 million barrels of oil into the SPR and you're making $20 a barrel off of it, that's $4 billion minus a bit for the costs of transacting that. It's not going to pay for the stimulus, but it's not a trivial amount of money either. It seems like it is worth something doing that for purely just to make money off the container.
Yes. You can buy a lot of vaccine research and ventilators with $4 billion. I would think.
Yes, you can.
Every dollar matters at this point.
Let's talk about what's going on with the production side worldwide and the price war that people are talking about. It seems that there has been a lot of cooperation until a few months ago between the Saudis and Russia and OPEC more generally, keeping prices at a much higher level. I think it was just around the first of the year that prices were around $60 a barrel. And now we are seeing a much more aggressive production. My interpretation is that this is what a competitive oil market looks like. It's not that the Saudis are trying to produce oil that they're actually losing money on. They're simply deciding that if they aren't going to get the cooperation, they are going to go revert to a competitive market. It's unclear why the U.S. is interested in doing something different than that. From a national point of view, obviously from an oil producer's point of view, but we are seeing some surprising and pretty strong lobbying to help prop up the cartel.
Yeah, we certainly are, which is really shocking to me as well. So I agree with your take that the price war that we're seeing and what we're seeing Saudi Arabia do, I don't get the sense that they're producing below their cost or trying to be predatory in the standard antitrust way of what we think of predatory pricing to be. Right? I think, you know, knowing what Saudi Arabia's true production costs are is really hard. It's a private secretive national oil company. My sense is that, you know, whatever their costs are, it's still less than $20 a barrel, which is where we're sitting right now. So it looks like the market is actually being globally competitive, at least for the time being, which seems like something we should be celebrating rather than trying to push and cajole Saudi Arabia and Russia back into collusion, or let alone collude with them. Have you seen some of the reports coming out of Texas about folks in Texas lobbying the Railroad Commission, which if you don't know, the Railroad Commission in Texas is the regulator of all oil and gas in Texas and actually used to enforce collusion in Texas in the days before there was an OPEC. But there's thoughts of reviving the Railroad Commission's old role in imposing production quotas on producers in Texas.
And I've seen threads of discussion about the legality of this. And it sounds like while it would not be legal for the oil producers to get together and discuss this, it is legal for the Texas Railroad Commission to enforce it or to even call them together and tell them that this is what they're going to do in order to raise oil prices. Trump seems to be taking this seriously as a possibility. One of the interesting aspects of this is if you think about this sort of cartel, even if the U.S. joined it, as you mentioned earlier, if our oil costs $40 a barrel and the Saudi oil costs $10 a barrel, and we manage to get oil back up to $50 a barrel, almost all of the rents are going to the Saudis, because while U.S. oil producers would be able to profitably produce, they would be making rents of, say, $10 a barrel, and the Saudis would be making far, far more. So it's a cartel where our consumers would be paying much more for all of the oil, but most of the rents of that are not going to U.S. producers. They're going to producers elsewhere.
Yep, I agree totally that sort of, yeah, it seems like anything we do to try and encourage collusion to prop up the price of oil, we will effectively be shipping economic rents out of the country, which seems like the opposite of what we should be doing right now. And it's not just a U.S. thing either. If we think about sort of our major global trading partners who are also obviously suffering from this massive economic contraction brought about by COVID-19, many of these countries are also net oil consumers. Think about China and Japan in particular. They're a massive net
and
oil consumers.
And all of Europe.
Much of Europe, exactly. So, you know, anything that happens to increase oil prices will hurt them and effectively just slow down the global recovery if and when we're able to get the economy started up again and come out of quarantine.
Yeah, it seems like it is a pretty nutty policy from an economic point of view. It also sets a horrible precedent. One would think if one state can decide that they would be better off by forming a cartel among their producers. I'm in California, where we produce a lot of agricultural products and are the primary producer of many of those products worldwide. And you could certainly talk about doing the same thing. It has, of course, been done in ag. There have been attempts in the past for regulators to restrict production, and there still are in some industries. Economists generally frown on that, and of course the economic implications of that are much smaller than the economic implications of propping up a cartel in oil production. I wanted to also talk about downstream, what's going on. We're also seeing gasoline prices drop in some ways even more drastically at the wholesale level. It hasn't come through to retail yet, but the wholesale production or wholesale prices, this morning I was checking the EIA website, are generally in the 35 to 50 cent a gallon range, which means that gasoline is actually selling for about the same or slightly cheaper than the oil that goes into producing it. It seems that part of what's going on is the split between heating oil diesel production and gasoline production, because diesel hasn't fallen nearly as much.
Yeah, that, and I suppose that makes sense. If we, it's hard to sort of come by, you know, demand figures in real time. Hopefully we'll get some more information on this soon from the Energy Information Administration. It's not crazy to think that with folks everywhere around the world driving less, that gasoline demand would be really hit, and maybe diesel and heating oil less if sort of major industrial demand has fallen a bit, but not by as much. Large scale bulk shipping, things that use diesel, a lot of that economic activity is maybe going on more, certainly more so than personal driving. That's a guess, but it doesn't seem crazy.
And, but part of it, of course, is also jet fuel and jet fuel demand, which is, jet fuel is essentially the same as diesel, and the jet fuel demand must have just completely fallen off a cliff at this point. I get a daily email telling me about my flights being canceled and the changes in the schedules. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about, Ryan?
I think the other thing to think about that I've been thinking about is, you know, thinking about sort of, you know, supporting the U.S. oil industry, which I think is sort of a lot of the intent behind sort of these sort of efforts to encourage Saudi Arabia to collude or even get Texas to collude with them. I mean, there is truth to the fact that, you know, these industries have employees, people in the industry are being laid off. That's all there. That's not an argument for price supports. That's an argument for doing the things we're doing in the stimulus bill across the rest of the economy, in terms of supporting people who, in terms of supporting people who get laid off, supporting local communities who are struggling with public finance issues. I mean, those issues are real, and they're probably concentrated, very concentrated in particular parts of the country, like West Texas and Western North Dakota. What that suggests is sort of we need sort of their communities need assistance getting through the crisis and maybe having the transition. These are not arguments for artificially inflating the price of oil, which one won't do much to bring back jobs anyway. Just, we're not going to put oil prices back to 40 or 50 bucks a barrel anytime soon. And it's just going to incentivize production that shouldn't be going on.
And it's essentially bailing out mostly shareholders of oil companies who, you know, I'm sorry for everybody who's losing money, but they shouldn't be at the front of the line when we start thinking about who needs help through this crisis.
Exactly. Yeah, the equity owners, they know they're taking on price risk. If you own an oil company, you should know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
And sometimes this is how it goes.
Well, we will continue to watch oil markets, both for their own importance and for the barometer they're giving us on the macroeconomic impact of the pandemic. I haven't seen the real-time production numbers yet, but as we do, I'm sure they're going to be telling us part of where the economic slowdowns are. Thanks for joining me, Ryan. This has been a lot of fun.
Had a great time, Severin.
Talk to you soon.